Good morning to each of y'all. I'd like to greet y'all in Christ's name this morning. I don't know about y'all, but I am very grateful to be in a warm building this morning. This southern boy doesn't have much use for cold weather like this, and it's very nice to be in out of the cold. All right, it's Valentine's Day. I don't know what that means to y'all. I don't have a Valentine's Day message, but I did think maybe I'd make a few comments on it just before we go into the message here. It might be, and I believe it is, an overly commercialized holiday. It seems like the stores like every excuse they can to get you in there and pull all the green $100 bills out of your wallet that they can. But it can still be a good reminder to us. And I think we do well to don't over-dramatize the day, but remember it. Remember it. Husbands, love your wives. It's that simple. Give her the love that she deserves. You picked her out and you married her. Give her the credit she deserves for helping you in your life, getting to where you are now. Be man enough to admit that she helped you get there. Let your eyes and your love be for her and her only. The old saying of dance with the girl that brought you is a good one for us married men to remember. Remember that. And wives, respect your husband. We men have a deep need to feel respected by our spouse. That's just the way God made us. And when we feel disrespected by our wives, it hurts more than you realize. So give your husband the gift of respect. Even if we fail and we don't always deserve it, give us a second chance. And to the singles, just briefly, know that you are loved and your worth is not defined by whether you have a spouse or not. If you are a child of God, you are worth everything to Him and He loves you unconditionally. Be who God called you to be and know that you are loved and appreciated. The history books are full of single people who gave their life for God. And it's a good thing. In a lot of ways, they're more unhampered to do work in God's kingdom than us married folks. So to all of us, do everything we can to further God's kingdom. And a reminder for everybody, love all year long, not just on Valentine's Day. Make it a daily thing to love and respect each other and everyone around you. That's all I'm going to talk about on Valentine's Day. I don't know why I felt led to share that, but I guess because it's Valentine's Day. All right, on to the message. I titled it, A God Can Attitude. Y'all can turn, if you want to Daniel chapter 2. We'll be reading out of there later. A God can attitude. If y'all are like me, you grew up, I don't know all of y'all's background, but I grew up in a Christian home, and I was taught from little up that God can do impossible things. I grew up singing songs about God doing impossible things. And as a child, I had you can call it a childlike faith if you want to, of God doing impossible things. And that's all right and that's all good and there's nothing wrong with that. But for some reason, the older I get and the older I got, the more I lost that concept. And the more I guess as a man, wanted to be in control of my own life. Why do I struggle to believe that God promised to take care of me and know that God is a promise keeper, and yet I don't want to release everything into His control? Why is that so hard to do? Why do I, as a man, want to be in control? Is it because I think it's unmanly to admit that I'm not in control of my own life? Is it maybe because I'm scared of God, where God's going to take me if I do commit everything to Him? Is that maybe what my problem is? Is it maybe because I'm scared of what God might ask me to do? Is it a reflection of my lack of commitment if I refuse to turn control over to God. And it seems like this might be more, I don't know exactly how you women look at it, but it might be more of a man problem than a woman problem. I don't know, but it seems like us men struggle to release control of our lives and admit and want God's input in our life. And God did put DNA in our body, if you want to say, to be in control and to control our circumstances as much as we can. And that's not all bad. But when we think we have to control every aspect of our life, and we get to thinking that we do control our own life, that's when we get into problems. And so I am learning, ever so little bit at a time, that the more I can release and let God take control, the better off I am. It's a hard thing to learn, and I wish I could say that once I learned it once, I learned it, and now I'm good to go for the rest of my life, but that's unfortunately not how it works. So we're going to look at a man this morning who I greatly admire in the Bible. He knew undoubtedly who was in control, and he had no problem letting God be in control. I don't know how y'all look at the book of Daniel. I was reading through it recently for my devotions, and I knew this story was in here, but for some reason it hit me anew. I don't know why that was, but Daniel was a very inspiring man in the Old Testament. There's several characters in the Old Testament that stand out, but Daniel has always stood out to me. So let's read Daniel chapter 2. I'd like to read the whole chapter, but I'm not going to. That's a lot of verses. So let's start by reading 2 verses 1 through 23. And in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams wherewith his spirit was troubled and his sleep brake from him. Then the king commanded to call the magicians and the astrologers and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans for to show the king his dream. So they came and stood before the king. And the king said unto them, I have dreamed a dream, and my spirit was troubled to know the dream. Then spake the Chaldeans to the king in Sirach, O king, live forever. Tell thy servants the dream, and we will show thee the interpretation. And the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, The thing is gone from me. If you will not make known unto me the dreams with the interpretation thereof, ye shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be turned into a dunghill. And if ye show the dream and the interpretation thereof, ye shall receive of me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and the interpretation thereof. They answered again and said, Let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation of it. The king answered and said, I know of certainty that you would gain the time, because ye see the thing is gone from me. But if you will not make known unto me the dream, there is but one decree for you. For you have prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me, till the time be changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that ye can show me the interpretation thereof. The Chaldeans answered before the king and said, There is not a man upon the earth that can show the king's matter. Therefore, there is no king, nor lord, nor ruler that asketh such things at any magician or astrologer or Chaldean. And it is a rare thing that the king requireth. And there is none other that can show it before the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh. For this cause the king was angry and very furious and commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. And the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they sought Daniel and his fellows to be slain. And Daniel answered with the counsel and wisdom to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, which was gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. He answered and said to Arush, the king's captain, Why is the decree so hasty from the king? Then Arioch made the thing known unto Daniel, and Daniel went in and desired that the king would give him time, and that he would show the king the interpretation. Then Daniel went to his house and made the thing known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they would desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning this secret, that Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of Babylon. Verse 19, and then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night vision, and Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever, for wisdom and might are his. He changed the times and the seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them that know understanding. He revealeth the deep and secret things. He knoweth what is in the darkness, and the light dwelleth with him. I thank thee and praise thee, O thou God of my fathers, who have given me wisdom and might, and hast made known unto me now what we have desired of thee. For thou hast now made known unto us the king's matter. So going back to verse 1, we have Nebuchadnezzar, a sometimes seemingly rational king, and at other times one of the most unreasonable, volatile, order things on a whim type of a guy. Living under his rule would have undoubtedly, you would have had a lot of drama in your life. You could call him a drama king if you wanted to. He was good at that. But for all his seemingly crazy things, we'll talk about some of the things he did. He did actually accomplish some things. So he was, this story, if I did my research correctly, was in modern day Iraq. He completely destroyed Israel and destroyed Jerusalem, conquered Israel and destroyed Jerusalem. He was undoubtedly a good warrior and a good leader, and he had some very impressive building programs going on with tax dollars that he was using from countries he had conquered. He's credited with building, arguably, one of the seven wonders of the world. Anybody know what that was? What'd he build? Hanging Gardens of Babylon. So the story goes that he had a queen from the mountains of Iran. And she was very homesick for her mountains. And instead of taking her to the mountains, he decided to bring the mountains to her because he's Nebuchadnezzar and he can do whatever he wants to. And he had a massive garden built for her right on the outskirts of modern-day Baghdad. It's said that he, from what historians, archaeologists say, he built this. Somehow he put piers in the ground, and he piled up dirt on them. I don't know how he supported all his dirt. I don't know. Yeah, it's one of the wonders of the world. I guess that's why it's called that. It was 400 foot square and 75 feet high, and it had massive trees growing out of it. So it was heavy enough built that it supported all kinds of massive trees. Buckets on pulleys hidden by bushes pulled water up out of the, I think it was the Euphrates River, up the side of this artificial mountain and created an artificial waterfall. There was a Greek historian that described it. He described it this way. The approach to the garden sloped like a hillside, and several parts of the structure rose from one another, tier on tier. On this the earth had been piled and was thickly planted with trees of every kind, that by their great size and other charm gave pleasure to the beholder. So this was a man that was a force to be reckoned with. When he set his mind to do something, he could do it. He's also said to have paved the streets of his city. So we have this great, big, powerful man, king of the world, if you want to call him that at that time. But he had a problem. He had a dream. And the dream apparently terrified him. And he wanted to know what the meaning of this dream was. And lucky for him, he had a palace full of people he thought could help him. He had magicians, astrologers, sorcerers, and Chaldeans, which were known for their witchcraft at that time. And He called them and he said, tell me what this dream meant. And you could see in verse 5 how awful it was going to be if they didn't interpret this dream. And how wonderful it was going to be if they interpret the dream. But there was one catch. He wanted to make sure these were legit dream tellers. And so he put the stipulation in there that he's not going to tell them what the dream is. They have to tell him what he dreamed and then turn around and explain what it means. Now, how are you going to do that? How are you going to do that? Verse 4, you can see all these wise guys thought they were going to make this king happy and they were going to interpret it for him. Then comes the impossible test. Verse 7, you can see them almost scared, shakily, asking, tell us again what the dream is. And maybe they were hoping they misunderstood. If I'd have been in their shoes, I'd have sure been hoping I misunderstood what he was wanting me to do. And verse 8 and 9, he lets them know he's undoubtedly not kidding around. He really means what he says, and this was a test to see if they were real fortune dream tellers. Verse 10, they tell him that what he's asking is absolutely ridiculous, and there isn't a person that could tell him that answer except a God that's not a God of flesh. Isn't that interesting how they put that in there? Except a God not dwelling in flesh. Verse 12 and 13, he got very angry and made good on his irrational command and sentenced all of them to death. All of them. Including some that weren't even able to be there and defend themselves. And that someone was Daniel and his three friends. So verse 14, we have this man coming to arrest Daniel and his friends. And it seems this is the first time Daniel even knows about this irrational command. Verse 15, he asks, why is the decree so hasty? Another translation of hasty I found is harsh. Why is the king being so harsh? And this man tells Daniel everything. Verse 16, we see Daniel asking for extra time, and it seems the king granted him a little extra time to think about it. Maybe he was understanding by then that maybe he flew off the handle and made an irrational command. I don't know, but I had to wonder about that. In verse 17 and 18, we find Daniel getting his three friends together. And they took their problem to the only person that they knew could solve it. They took their problem to the only God that they knew could solve this predicament that they were in. And they prayed for their lives. Can you imagine what a prayer meeting they had? There probably wasn't a lot of chit-chat. There was probably some very earnest prayers being prayed. And verse 19 comes a blessed relief and a blessed miracle. And then from 19 down through 23, I read those already, so I'm not going to read them again. But you can feel the heartfelt praise of Daniel praising God for this miracle. And notice, he's praising God and thanking God for revealing it before he even presented it to the king and made sure it was the right dream. If that would have been me, I would have been just human enough to think, God, is that really the dream? Is that really the correct dream? How about I go check with the king before I just start singing and praising? But you don't see Daniel doing that. He may not have been very confident, but I got a feeling he was very confident he had the right dream. And then in verse 24 and 25, I didn't read those verses. It's kind of interesting. Daniel was entreating the king to save the lives of these other magicians and sorcerers and witchcraft people, if you want to call them that. He must have had a heart of gold and loved everybody, because Daniel was in the same category as these wise men, him and his three friends. I imagine they ran in the same circles and probably went to the same parties and probably hung out in some of the same rooms. They were all considered wise men. But you had two absolutely competing worldviews. So in my human mind, I can't help but imagine there was some conflict at times between these four Hebrew men and these, I don't know, however many other magicians there were. There was probably some conflict there at times, and probably some heated discussions. But you see Daniel only showing love to these men and entreating the king for them. Isn't that amazing? He could have been saying, aha, I knew you were Satan worshipers. I knew y'all are going down someday. God doesn't support people like you. And this is the time you're going. The king decreed it. And see, God's on my side. But you don't see Daniel doing that. Isn't that amazing? I think there's a lesson in there for us today. He had a good attitude toward these other people, and he wished nothing but the best for them. Can we do that today? Verse 28, he was talking to Nebuchadnezzar, and all the credit went straight back to God. Daniel didn't keep any of it for himself. He made known to the king it was not of his own doings. And then verses 31 through 45... y'all can read that this afternoon if you need some good reading. Daniel vividly describes the dream and the interpretations of the king, and apparently he is spot on. This high and mighty king, this man that does everything seemingly of his own strength, this rash, make silly, spur of the moment's law king, fell down on his face and worshipped. He was a very feared king, and he was brought to his knees by Daniel's God. Isn't that amazing? Verse 46 through 49, I am going to read those. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face and worshiped Daniel and commanded that they should offer an oblation and sweet odors unto him. And the king answered unto Daniel and said, of truth it is that your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of secrets, seeing that thou couldest reveal this secret. And the king made Daniel a great man and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and the chief of the governors over the wise men of Babylon. And Daniel requested of the king and sent Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the providence of Babylon, but Daniel sat in the king's gate. So whether King Nebuchadnezzar understood exactly who God was at that moment, I don't really think he did, but he did realize there was something supernatural going on here. He did realize there was a God that can do the impossible. And he was impressed. He was impressed. Daniel trusting and believing that God can, and God can do the impossible, saved him and his three friends and all the wise men condemned to die. So how do I get this God can do it attitude? How can I get that in my life? Let's look at a few things. So Daniel, let's look at how Daniel got some of this. I don't have a conclusive list here. I got a couple of points. Number one, I think how Daniel got this attitude. And it sounds so simple, but very obviously, Daniel wanted God's input. He didn't only want it, he made it his whole life goal to find God's will for his life and to live in that will when he found it. It sounds so simple. It's almost too simple, but you have to want it. You have to want it. God doesn't, he's not just going to dump it on you. You have to want it and you have to seek it. Sometimes I meet people and I myself say, I want this unwavering faith. I do. I want it. But do I really want it bad enough to turn everything loose to get it? Am I willing to go that far? One thing about God, he's not going to force it on us. He created us humans free to make our own decisions. He wants people that serve him out of a true desire to follow him. And when I try to hang on the controls and try to control as much of my life as I can and maybe give some of the little stuff to God, it doesn't work very good. How would you like to be coming in on a flight from somewhere and you feel the plane jumping up and down, carrying on. Maybe if you'd like a roller coaster ride, you might like that ride. I don't know. But for some reason, the cockpit doors open, and you look up there, and you see the pilot on one side yanking the controls and the co-pilot on the other side yanking the controls. All of a sudden, if you liked a roller coaster ride, the fun feeling might go away. It doesn't work when there's two people yanking on the controls, one trying to go one way and do it his way, and the other do it his way. It's much better when God's in control. It just is. And it wasn't that Daniel was a wimpy type of a guy. He obviously had a lot of backbone, but he knew where his strength come from. He knew where it came from. Daniel wanted God's input, and he sought it. And we also need to want it and seek it. Point number two. You'll find Daniel doing this in verse 18. No, verse 17. Daniel gathered his friends around him. Maybe they gathered together because they were all in the same boat. I don't know. But I got a feeling if it would have just been Daniel that was going to be executed the next day, he would have still gathered his friends around him. There's something about gathering with friends that encourages us and makes us understand that we have encouragement and support around us. That helps me, at least, even though I know my life is in God's control, it helps to be around like-minded people. It just does. It says they desired the mercies of the Lord. Very plain and very simple. They gathered with their friends and they desired the mercy of the Lord. No matter how big of a person we may be, and no matter how much we think we can handle it on our own, it's still, there's something about that support that good friends and a church life brings us. That's why I think church is important. There's something about companionship and being in a circle of like-minded people that is brings a level of confidence. That's probably not the right word, but it brings a level of knowing that we have help. We have support. We talked about that some in Sunday school class this morning. Verse 19, I might go back there just a little bit. It says God revealed it to him in a vision at night. And Daniel might have been awake when God revealed this vision to him, but I could almost get the idea that Daniel went to sleep. He might have not. I don't know. But I got the feeling he did. And what a man that he went to sleep with the promise that the next day he's going to die, or the day after that. I think it showed he had a lot of faith in God. And he possessed a childlike faith that God was going to work this out. Daniel isn't the only story in the Bible like this. There's a lot of others. But Daniel was a man that he knew where he stood. He knew that God had his back. And he knew that God can do the impossible. Sometimes it seems like when Jesus talked about faith is a grain of a mustard seed, he was talking straight to me. What do I have to do to get a faith like Daniel? Daniel was an impressive man here. There's a story I'll tell you of a man that was captured in the Vietnam War. He had a horrible prison life. He had guards that loved to torment him. But he was a Christian, and he was trying his best in there, in the situation he was in, to live his godly life as best as he could, but he was nearly at the end of his rope. He had no support, he had no Bible, he had no hardly anything. All his rights were stripped of him. And one day he was ordered once more to go clean the nasty outhouses, and he hated cleaning the outhouses out. It was an awful job, especially in the heat and the humidity of where he was at. And he had taken just about all he could handle. And his prayer was, "Lord, are you even there? Are you even listening? And if you are there, why don't you act like you care? I need a sign, God. I'm nearly about to give up down here. Is it really worth trying to live a Christian life in this prison camp if you're going to abandon me like this?" He was praying for a sign, praying that God would show him that he really cared. And he went about his depressing job of cleaning out the outhouse one more time. And out of the corner of his eye, he caught a glint of paper. And he reached down into the toilet and he pulled out one page. And I know it sounds like a dirty job, and it was, but he was desperate. And he cleaned it off, and wonder of wonders, it was one page out of the book of Romans. And he took that as a sign, grateful to God that God cared for him even where he was. The next day he went back and he cleaned the outhouse with a little bit bigger smile. And wouldn't you know, there was a second page in there. And the day after that, there was another page. And the day after that, there was another page. And before long, he had nearly the whole book of Romans. And here what happened is somebody gave one of the guards a Bible, and he thought he was using it in the most despicable way that he could. But God was working through this evil man to encourage this man in prison. Isn't that amazing that God takes even evil men and their evil intentions, and they think they're doing the worst thing they can, and he turns it around for his children's good? Isn't that amazing? God uses even evil men to take care of his children. Just when one of God's children was at his wit's end and thought there was nothing but the impossible left, God reached down and performed this miracle. And here I am, not nearly in the same shoes as that man. And I think I have big problems someday. And they seem big in my world sometimes. And I think God can't fix my little problems sometimes. And I read stories like this, and it's encouraging that God does care about you. He does care about me. He cares about his children way more than we know. Luke 18, verse 27 said, "And he said, 'The things that are impossible with men are impossible with God.'" There's three more here that I just kind of pulled out here and there. Some of them might be kind of out of context, but I think they still have a point. Genesis 18:14 says, "Is anything too hard for God? At the time appointed, I will return unto thee according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son." Romans 4:21 says, "And being fully persuaded that what he promised, he was also able to perform." And Jeremiah 32:17, I like this verse. Listen to this. "Ah, Lord God, behold, thou hast made the heaven and the earth. By thy great power and stretched out arm, there is nothing too hard for thee." I kind of get the idea that God likes to watch us get into a bind where we think we can't get out. And then he just loves to reach down and help you out and perform what you think is impossible. But we have to let him. Does that make sense? We have to allow him to do it. We have to turn it over to him. We have a God that can do the impossible, whether we believe it or not, but we must allow him to do it. You have to want it, you have to seek it, and when you find it, you have to let him control it. Jeremiah, I'm going to read three more verses here in closing. Jeremiah 29:11. I know I've shared this verse with y'all before, but it's one of my favorites. "For I know the thoughts that I think toward you, saith the Lord, thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give you an expected end." That's what God thinks about us, peace and not evil. Ephesians 3, verse 20 says, 3:20 and 21, Now unto him that is able to do exceedingly abundant, above all that we ask or think, according to the power that worketh in us, unto him be glory in the church by Christ Jesus throughout all the ages, world without end. Amen. I guess the challenge I want to leave, not for y'all, but mostly for myself, is we do have a God that can do it. But do we have the God can do it attitude? Or am I trying in my feeble, manly ways to control my life? Is that what I'm trying to do? Or am I willing just to let go and let God do it? That's all I have this morning. Why don't we stand for prayer?